collaboration between my lab, which is in the Aeronautics and Astronautics Department at Stanford, and the lab of Jeff Axelrod, who is a professor in the Department of Pathology in the School of Medicine at Stanford. And it's largely the work of our PhD students. Keith Monlier-Domont was a PhD student of mine. He just finished last year. And Robin Raffard is also a PhD student of mine, a current PhD student. And Dali Ma was a PhD student of Jeff's in the cancer biology program. And she just finished her PhD a couple of months ago. Okay, so I'm the control, my background's in control theory and mathematics, and Jeff's a biologist. So, but we have a pretty close collaboration in terms of working together. My lab does a lot of the modeling, his lab does the experiments, but there's quite a tight feedback loop in terms of the feedback loop between modeling and experiment. So I'm going to start off by talking about the particular problem that kind of brought us together that Jeff was interested in. So it's the initial slides are largely about the work in Jeff's lab. And then I'm going to talk about the questions that came up, and then the modeling effort that we did, and then the results and the implications. Okay, so Jeff's lab is concerned with a particular mechanism that affects what is known as planar cell polarity. And he studies flies. He has a fly lab. And so there's a couple of images here. So here's an image we saw yesterday. It's a fly wing. Proximal side is the side closest to the fly body. Distal side is the side closest. It's the wing tip side. And basically, all of the images in this talk are going to be oriented in such a way that the left-hand side of the image represents the proximal side, and the right-hand side of the image represents the distal side. Okay, so if you look at the wing of a fruit fly, and here's a patch of a sort of blow-up of this part of the wing, you can see the veins that were talked about yesterday. What you see is that, and here's a sort of stylized form showing the cells, you see that every cell, they're packed in two planar arrays. So there's a planar array of cells on the top and a planar array of cells on the bottom. At a certain point in development of the fly, each cell grows a little hair, and the hair always grows on the distal side of the cell, and it always points towards the wingtip. And so the hair is seen as a kind of readout, an observation of the polarity of the cell. And the question that Jeff's lab is concerned with answering is, how does a single cell in an array of tens of thousands of cells know which side is distal and which side is proximal? So how does a cell determine its own polarity? Now, this is a very important question for flies. In terms of the fly, these hairs are conserved across not only the wing, but the body of the fly. And it's generally understood that the hairs improve the hydrophobic properties of the fly. So having a nice array of hairs pointed in a common direction allows little raindrops to easily roll off the body of the fly. It improves the hydrophobic properties. Interestingly, coming from an aero department, it actually reduces the lift. These little hairs reduce the lift-drag ratio of the fly. So initially people thought, well, it's for the aerodynamics. But there were some experiments done by Michael Dickinson at Caltech who found out that that's not actually true.
Why do they have to be lined up to repel water?
Well, I mean, lined up in a way that it improves like the gradient of, in terms of raindrops rolling off. So you could imagine if they were sort of pointed in different directions that you might get them raindrops collecting and sort of, these are small animals, so kind of destroying the fly. Okay, so it's an important mechanism for flies, but
question? Trying to put this, what other language could we use instead of how does the cell know which polarity it is? How can we change that kind of concept of a cell knowing anything?
So another way to say it, which is perhaps the more correct way, I guess, is...
Well, correct, but just away from this kind of language, so that we talk more about materials and their behaviors and responses to gradients and this kind of thing.
So what is the mechanism, the regulatory network that sets up the circuitry for the hair to grow at this particular point? What is the program within the epithelial cell? It's, as I said, it's an important question for flies, but the reason that I think a lot of people are interested in the cell polarity problem is that it's an extremely important problem in general in development. And there are, so I'm going to talk about this mechanism, which is a protein regulatory network that helps determine the polarity of the cell. And some of those proteins in that network are conserved across different organisms. And indeed, in humans, there's a syndrome, a congenital deafness syndrome called Usher's syndrome, which is a result of a malformation of hairs in the inner ear, in the cochlea. And some of the proteins in the inner ear are, they share the same proteins with this fly mechanism. Similarly, spina bifida, so the failure for neural tubes to close in humans. Actually, there's been some experiments done in frogs in which, again, the same proteins that are involved in this circuit, if they're mutant in frogs, the spinal tube fails to close. So it's thought that there's a link between polarity, the polarity genes, proteins, and spina bifida, so some human disorders. And there's Wnt is involved, so there's a link with the canonical Wnt pathway.
What is the range of the angle?
It's all based on observations, but it's generally thought that in a wild type wing, it's about, this is based on my observations, it's about plus or minus 20 or 30 degrees. So they're pointing in the general direction. But you see trends, so you'll see trends, like they're not pointing exactly distally, but they tend to line up their polarity with their neighboring. Some of them. Well, I don't know about their nervous systems, but it, you mean related to spina bifida? I'm not sure if that experiment has been done in the fly. So these are frog experiments and some mouse experiments they did for spina bifida. I'll show you some mutants, and we were just looking at the effect of mutants on the actual wing cells. But there are some mutants that actually kill, if you mutate fat, for example, it kills the fly. So you have to do it in sort of small localized patches. So I don't really know the general, and it upsets the formation of joints in the legs of the fly. But those are kind of the experiments that I know about apart from those on the wing. Okay, so there's a fairly substantial community of people working in planar cell polarity, and it's been going on. The studies have been going on for a number of years. And so there's a number of experiments that we can draw on, and indeed some of them have been done by Jeff's lab, in terms of identifying the key signaling proteins that form the mechanism that results in planar cell polarity. Okay, and so there are at least four, and there are more, but four of the key signaling proteins have been identified. And they've been identified basically by experiments which knock out these genes in the developing fly. And then the polarity of the cells is observed to be disrupted from what its wild-type situation would be. So four of these proteins are, and some of these have been mentioned already in the workshop, disheveled, frizzled, prickle, and Van Gogh. And these images show the fluorescent staining for the green fluorescent protein for each of these signaling proteins. So the way these experiments were done is that, so this represents a cell on the wing, and all of these cells all of the cells in the wing in all of these experiments have all of the key signaling proteins, but the dark masses, the cells are here, and they are operating normally, but these cells around here are mutant for the disheveled GFP. And doing that kind of experiment allows you to see where on the cell these proteins are localizing. Okay, so what happens? At about 18 hours after the puparium forms, you can open up the pupae and look at the cells on the wing, and you can observe the, depending on what experiment you're doing, the fluorescence of these GFPs tagged to these signaling proteins. And it's observed that initially, so we start the experiments around 18 hours after puparium formation, these proteins are localized They're sort of localized either uniformly throughout the cytoplasm if they're cytoplasmic proteins, or throughout the cell membrane if they're membrane proteins. And then over the course of about 12 to 15 hours, so between about 18 hours to 30 or 35 hours after the puparium forms, these proteins start to localize asymmetrically. And in the normal developing fly, disheveled and frizzled localize to the distal side of each cell, and Prickle and Van Gogh localize to the proximal side of the cell. And it's generally understood that the hair grows from the distal portion, so we observe that the hair grows from the distal portion of each cell, and it's observed that the hair tends to grow where disheveled protein is localized the highest. Okay, so a number of other experiments have been done, and these experiments were actually done previously to the experiments that I showed on the previous slide. So these were kind of the experiments that started people asking questions about, or trying to sort of understanding what proteins were involved in this regulatory network. And these are the kind of experiments that, you know, really excite somebody from, say, control theory, where we're interested in designing, for example, local control systems for systems of systems in which you have local interaction producing some kinds of global results, so general patterning. Okay, so what are these experiments? Well, experiments can be done in which each of the signaling proteins can be knocked out, their function can be knocked out from patches of cells on the wing. So here's a patch of cells that is mutant for the protein frizzled. So there's no frizzled activity in these cells. And you can see that, well actually you can't really see, but these hairs tend to be growing from the center of each cell. But you can see that there's three hairs per cell, so these cells are kind of screwed up. And that's what you might expect. It doesn't have one of the key signaling proteins. But more interestingly, you see that the presence of that mutant clone has disrupted the polarity on the distal side of the clone. And so the hairs on the distal side of the clone are pointing in the...
There's a main question. How do they know the mutant is only in that patch?
Because they can... So they do an experiment to knock out the function of that protein while the wing is developing. And then when they observe the fly, they don't know it's going to be in that particular patch, but they can stain for that protein function and see that it's missing from that patch. Okay. They do the experiments basically by doing heat shock of a particular cell or a small number of cells, and then as the cells divide, you end up getting these patches which don't have that function. So you see that there's a disruption in polarity, and interestingly, that disruption tends to correct itself after a little while. So you see by about here, polarity is back to normal, and over here on the proximal side of the clone, there was no disruption in polarity. If you knock out Van Gogh, one of the other signaling proteins, so inside this black line, Van Gogh has been knocked out, you tend to see the disruption of polarity, but this time on the proximal side of the clone rather than the distal side. So this was observed, and as this was observed, a number of people working in this planar cell polarity community started to propose models for how the different signaling proteins were interacting with each other. And a number of the models invoked diffusible factors. So there's in one of the models, there's a suggested factor X, which is meant to be represent a protein which may be diffusing through a number of cells, causing the reversal in polarity. There was another model that suggested a factor Z. The reason they're called factor X and factor Z is because, despite extensive experimental search for these proteins, they haven't been discovered. And so, so that was a sort of interesting point, that there were some models that had been proposed which said that in order to get this effect, you require a diffusible factor. Okay, so when we started working with Jeff, which was, I guess, about 5 years ago, he and his group had just published an initial model, a proposed model for the mechanism underlying planar cell polarity. And so this is the model that Jeff, and so David Tree was one of Jeff's postdocs. And the model is shown here. Basically the model is representing influences between these proteins. And so a positive arrow indicates a promotion effect or a positive influence, and this line here represents an inhibitory effect. And here here I'm just showing the model between two cells, so across a cell membrane. And the model says the following, that frizzled, which is a membrane protein, promotes the recruitment of disheveled, which is a cytoplasmic protein, to the membrane. And then disheveled further stabilizes that localization with frizzled, so the localization of both disheveled and frizzled to the membrane. Through perhaps a different pathway, frizzled promotes the localization of Van Gogh and Prickle on the membrane of a neighboring cell. And Prickle and perhaps Van Gogh in turn inhibit the recruitment of disheveled to the boundary. And so this diagram is showing a couple of things. It's showing the influence effect, or the proposed influences. And it's also showing through the fonts where the proteins tend to localize in wild type. So you tend to see disheveled and frizzled localizing on the distal side of each cell, and Van Gogh and Prickle localizing on the proximal side of the cell. You don't tend to see disheveled and frizzled localizing on the proximal, and you don't tend to see Prickle and Van Gogh localizing on the distal. And this is just a diagram indicating what's sort of known about these proteins. So it's known that frizzled is a 7-pass membrane protein, and so it's indicated as a membrane protein. Disheveled is a cytoplasmic protein. Interestingly, in the original model, it wasn't actually this model. Van Gogh wasn't included in the model in this paper. And Van Gogh, the inclusion of Van Gogh in this model was something that was introduced over the course of our collaboration. So it was understood that there had to be some other protein because frizzled is a membrane protein. It couldn't interact with Prickle in the neighboring cell because Prickle is a cytoplasmic protein. So there had to be a protein in between, and it was proposed that that protein is indeed Van Gogh.
Was there any evidence for these interactions, or did you just postulate because you knew it would work?
There was some initial evidence for, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So these are interactions. They could be encoded, you know, they could be sort of implemented by the cells, by the proteins in many different ways. We're actually going to implement this interaction as a binding of those two proteins. And there still isn't a lot of evidence that these proteins bind together. But over the course of our modeling effort, we did some experiments to actually validate, for example, that disheveled and frizzled do bind together. So there was some other experimental evidence to suggest that one. And we've done some other experiments. So that it was really starting from not very much known about this system at all. The crystalline structures of these proteins are not well known.
Is it known whether the growth of the hairs proceeds everywhere at once in a wing, or whether it starts at one end and migrates over as some kind of propagating process?
I'm not sure. I think it tends to happen everywhere at once, but I could be wrong. The growth of the hair happens around 32 to 35 hours after the puparium starts to form. And it's interesting, it's on a kind of timer. So this circuit, or whatever this circuit is, it tends to act. And then after a particular amount of time, which is at about 32 to 35 hours, the hair will grow. And regardless of where disheveled is, the hair will grow where disheveled is. But whether or not it grows in waves, or it develops first at the root to the tip, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it might be important to point out this isn't a hair from a follicle kind of thing, right? But I was just Googling it, and it's an actin filament.
It's a trichome.
It comes from the microvilli. It's part of the cytoskeleton. So as cytoskeleton develops, these are they're an extension of that through microvilli. So, you know, there's a biological connection to the material in the cell now. It's these actin bundles.
Right, so the localization of disheveled is thought to set up the machinery for the actin bundle to start growing this trichome, which I'm calling a hair, but more correctly it's a trichome.
I just wonder how many more names we can come up with for maybe the same thing, like actin filament.
The proteins are named after generally who discovered them. So Van Gogh is so named because it's generally observed in these little punctate, like these little dots. And so it's got another name, it's called Starry Night. So that's kind of interesting. But people tend to name them like sometimes based on their shape, or sometimes they're named after the lab that discovered them. It's a very interesting and rich naming system.
case, is there any alternative classification system that maybe contains information about how proteins are related, rather than each thing being a wonderful individual with a unique quality all to itself?
I think there's a lot of literature on how proteins are related across different organisms. Yet I don't think the naming system as yet really reflects that. That, and I'm a mathematician, and that's my observation of this.
Biologists love to name things. That's
any other questions?
Mathematicians like to name things.
Yeah.
I guess what I was trying to drive at was, there's a gene for actin, and why is this different than the other genes for actin?
No, I mean, it has these special qualities. That's why it's different.
Yeah,
I mean, this is.
Yeah,
so you got to listen carefully to the particular properties of these proteins.
Yeah.
I mean, and the names are created when the mutant is found, and you look at the phenotype, and so you need to name that. You need to name that phenotype. It's got to be unique. So usually has 2, 3, 4 letters. It's enough scope for uniqueness.
So for example. There's a protein that we're studying called four-jointed, F-O-U-R jointed. And it's so named because in its mutant, the fly leg forms 4 joints as opposed to the regular. When I started working on this, I asked the very same question. A nomenclature, a numbering system is needed. But as I've been working on this for about 5 years, I've come to really like the naming. Okay, so the idea, the proposal is that this is a local feedback loop, so you see positive, you see negative feedback between cells, and that feedback loop is amplifying some unknown, as yet unknown, directional cue. So if this point is that this feedback loop requires something to break the initial asymmetry. And one of the questions was, could we use this modeling effort to help try to understand what that directional cue might be? Okay, so back to the directional cue. There had been a number of experiments in the fly eye, which a lot by Mike Simon, who's also at Stanford, in which this protein fat was observed in a gradient across the eye of the fly. And so there were some experiments done by Dally in Jeff's lab, in which she formed, again, mutants for fat. So the cells inside this yellow line don't have the protein fat. And so here's another mutant for fat. And she made some very interesting observations about this. So she found that in the absence of fat, the feedback loop amplifies and propagates polarity across the clone. Okay, so in this image, the actin, red represents the actin staining. And you see that in the absence of fat, the polarity is still propagated across this clone. However, she observed that in some cases, the polarity doesn't always propagate correctly. But it results, if it doesn't propagate correctly, you tend to see some very interesting characteristic patterns. And the patterns are, so you can sort of see it here, these kind of representative swirly patterns. So these were, and if you look closely, you see that each cell is tending to align its polarity with its neighboring cells. However, the indication to the cells about which side is proximal and which side is distal has been lost. So cells are tending to locally align their polarity, yet they've lost global polarity. And so one of the questions from these experiments we wanted to answer is, how would we account for the variability of polarity defects in fat clones? Sometimes you see that polarity is propagated, and sometimes you see it's not. Okay, so the hypothesis then is that this planar cell polarity circuit, the mechanism underlying it, involves this local feedback loop, which is reading some global directional cue, and we hypothesize that that global directional cue is provided by fat. And even though experiments have been done to look at possible indications of fat gradients across the wing, the signal is too noisy and low. You don't tend to see a gradient in fat across the wing. But that might be because of the existing measurement technique.
reflection of that, so that's that you have some sort of source area and you could imagine a gradient. This is what no one should see as it's transcribed.
So we're not sure. The hypothesis is that fat might have, you know, started from that there may be some initial concentration from either the root of the wing or from the boundary that's providing that gradient. But it's not well known, and I'll show you some experiments in a little bit that we think what seems to be very necessary is that fat needs to be sort of persistent around all cells in the wing. So you see across these fat clones that, I mean, you can make very large clones and still get some propagation of polarity. So that it has to indicate that there is some fat, there's some fat over here that sort of is persisting, that amount is, it's not decaying and disappearing. Okay, so Jeff published this model, and this is kind of a neat community. From my experience, it's been sort of controversial, but immediately there were a number of other papers that were published saying there's no way this model can be right. Some of the sources of controversy were that people said, well, this model cannot explain some of the data we've observed. So here's some of the points, some of the sources of controversy. So I showed you an image where we removed frizzled, where Jeff's lab had removed frizzled from a patch of cells. And it's observed that those are non-autonomous. So this term non-autonomous, I forgot to mention this earlier, but the term non-autonomy means that the fate of the cell is determined by something other than its own genes. And so if you see this mutant behavior in which cells distal to the clone, so cells which have all of the correct signals have a polarity defect, that indicates that their behavior is non-autonomous, that they're doing something, their fate is not determined by what's inside. So the term, and people often say domineering non-autonomy to mean this, basically we're using it to mean the disruption of polarity in healthy cells, in wild-type cells. And so on the other side, autonomous behavior means that the behavior of the cell is only determined by its own constituent components, its own genes. Okay, so some sources of controversy is that while we observe that the null frizzled clones are non-autonomous, so there is a polarity defect outside of that clone, if you remove disheveled from a patch of cells on the wing, you don't see that domineering non-autonomy. So you don't see this disruption of polarity outside of the clone. So, and that's interesting because disheveled and frizzled seem to be pretty tightly coupled within this loop. If you look at that as a control theorist, you might tend to think that if you knock out disheveled, it would have the same behavior as if you knocked out frizzled, and that's not true. Interestingly, some versions of frizzled, so some frizzled alleles, slightly different versions of that protein, if you remove those, if you form a wing that in which the frizzled protein is this particular frizzled allele, and then you remove that frizzled from a patch of cells on the wing, you observe an autonomous polarity phenotype. So slightly changing frizzled has the effect of removing this disruption of polarity outside of the clones of that protein. Then if you look at another source of controversy, is if some people had done this experiment before, is if you increase there's been a lot of experiments not only knocking out the function of all these proteins, but also overexpressing these proteins and therefore their function. And if you look at this loop, and you think about what would happen if you overexpress prickle, so you increase this signal. Well, in this feedback loop, prickle acts to inhibit the recruitment of disheveled to the boundary. So one might think that if prickle were increased, one would see a lower recruitment, a lower amount of disheveled at the boundary. Actually, in experiment, you see the opposite effect. Okay, so there was some controversy about this model when it came out. And that's when we started working with Jeff. Basically, the idea was, could we, and I think this is one of the interesting successes so far of systems biology, is there's an intuitive leap that you have to make between molecular signaling and tissue level patterning. So it's very difficult, if not impossible, to look at that local feedback loop and intuit what will happen over networks of cells, what will happen in terms of the tissue level patterning. And a mathematical model helps you bridge that intuitive leap that you have to make. It allows you to encode this in different types of equations, so different hypotheses of how you might encode this, and then observe the tissue level patterning and try to understand whether or not, yes, it is possible to get all of the observed experimental behavior, including these, with just this particular model. And the question we were in particular interested in answering is, can we do this without invoking an additional factor X or a factor Z?
So I'm going to question from the computational side of things. If you want to do this sort of tissue level model, you have lots and lots of cells, let's say. How would you do this kind of network?
And that's actually what took us a long time to do. So I'm going to talk about that, because that's how you now choose an appropriate model, which has to be a compromise between complexity and implementability. You want to choose a model which you can solve numerically in a reasonable amount of time. So that's concerned us. That's been our major concern in the course of this project. So in thinking about how we might first model this system, we had a number of different options. And these are models that have been exploited by different people in this community already. One possible option is a fully discrete model, like a Boolean model that was talked about earlier today. So you might think about taking this, let's call it an influence diagram, and encoding it in a set of Boolean statements. So for example, if disheveled on the distal side is high, then frizzled on the distal side should be high. If frizzled on the distal side is high, then prickle on the proximal side of the neighboring cell should be high. The problem with this model for us is that it's basically saying exactly the same thing that this diagram is explaining, and that's the source of controversy. Okay, so then we can think about a model which is perhaps a step closer to the kinetics of the biological components. And so we've also worked in hybrid models. Hybrid models are so called because they combine a discrete event logic with a usually quite simple continuous dynamics, which are an abstraction of what's actually going on in the biological system. So for example, we might think of a finite automaton in which there are continuous dynamics in each state describing the growth and decay of the protein concentrations. So state Q1 might represent the condition that disheveled on the distal side is greater than the threshold needed to switch on frizzled. So this is high enough to start activating the production of frizzled, or the recruitment of frizzled to that side of the boundary. And then, so if this is true, then this equation holds, which is just a simple linear or affine ordinary differential equation, which says that the change in the concentration over time of frizzled on the distal side depends on the current concentration of frizzled on the distal side plus some activation factor, which could be constant. And these would be unknown parameters that we would have to identify. Why is this nice? Because this is a linear system. If we're switching between different linear systems, it's a piecewise, so different affine systems, it's a piecewise affine system. There exist toolkits of methods to analyze mathematically piecewise affine systems in huge dimensions. So it's an appealing model. However, for us, and we did do some work on this, but it doesn't actually answer the question, it doesn't allow us to answer the particular questions that we're being asked, which are really, is this a plausible model? This is too abstract. It doesn't invoke any kind of mechanisms of molecular movement through cells. It's not close enough to the biology to be able to convince biologists that this is actually correct. And so a third level down, and this is by no means exhaustive, of course, is a continuous model, and in this continuous model, one can think about partial differential equations describing the change in protein concentration over time as a function of the change in protein concentration across the spatial variable, so around the cells. And I'm going to spend the rest of the talk talking about, this has been our most successful model to date, And so I'm going to talk about how we worked with this model and the results that we got from it. But very briefly, this is a reaction, it's a very standard reaction diffusion equation in which these terms represent forward and reverse reactions, and this represents a diffusion term. And all of these.
You have more variables, more dependent variables than just the one list variable.
And it's a system.
Yeah, this is just one example. So these dot, dot, dot are meant to represent that there are a lot of others. But there's a lot of unknowns too. So we have the forward reaction rates, reverse reaction rates, and I'll talk a little bit.
Does each cell have a partial differential equation and even boundary conditions between cells?
Each cell is going to have a number of PDEs and the boundary conditions within each cell around, as well as boundary conditions in networks of cells.
Yeah,
so it's
we have one PDE for each of the six sites. Is this correct?
We're going to have, there's going to be, in fact, 10 PDEs that I talk about. And they're going to be, depending on what kinds of grids we use, those PDEs will be on the boundaries as well as acting inside. But there's no membrane proteins inside, so even though those PDEs are there, there's nothing, for example, for disheveled to react to. But disheveled exists, for example, in the membrane, so it's moving according to that equation and diffusing according to that equation.
How many copies of these proteins per cell?
We don't know, but it's there's enough of each protein that we can actually see its fluorescence. And so by that, and talking to some biochemists about this, we justified the use of deterministic rather than stochastic models. That we are assuming that we have enough of these molecules that we can talk about deterministic and therefore sort of average models as opposed to stochastic models. So I'm going to skip over the hybrid model. We did some work on this, and it was actually quite interesting because we could do a lot of analysis, but again, it was too abstract to be able to answer the questions that we wanted to ask.
It seems like you're neglecting production and degradation of the molecules, or is that included in somewhere? Like,
so
are
there's
you assuming that the total number over all forms are considered?
So there's the forward reaction and the reverse reaction, which is, so we have some initial concentrations of these proteins, and then as I talk about, we're going to be forming complexes, and those have initial concentration zero, so they're forming and they're decaying accordingly.
But I'm talking about the yes, like the half-life of the protein is being broken down by protease or produced by gene expression.
Yeah, and we're assuming that the amounts of proteins in the cell are remaining constant in terms of the cell as a unit. So we're looking at these as ways of moving these proteins around the cell.
So,
yeah.
But is it known if that's a good approximation?
It's not known. But in terms of the reason we justified that assumption is, again, by looking at these intensities over time between the 18 and 32 hour window. It may be wrong, but it was a good assumption to start with. So let me talk, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about the continuous model, and then the largest problem mathematically is, I think, as many of you know, is the parameter identification problem, and so we spent a lot of time thinking about how to do that. I'll talk about that briefly, and then I'll move to the results and what we've been doing recently with this model. Okay, so in terms of the states in our model, we had our original four proteins. And then we introduced six complexes, which are basically going to encode the logic of that influence diagram that we started with. So we introduced a complex which we're going to call disheveled frizzled. And it's basically assuming that it's a way of encoding the positive influence between disheveled and frizzled. It's mathematically, it's making the assumption that disheveled and frizzled are binding together. But as we know, there could be some, say, intermediate component in that binding, in that promotion effect, which is there but we don't know about yet. So it's basically a mathematical representation of a positive influence. And one of the things that we've been looking at is that, you know, are these really, are they really biological components, i.e., is there a complex called Van Gogh prickle? We don't know yet, but it's a hypothesis of the model. If we do find that there isn't such a complex, yet there's some intermediate protein that's binding Van Gogh and prickle and causing that positive influence, it would be easy to update the model because the influence is encoded in that binding. So we introduced six complexes, and you may ask, well, there are more than six possible permutations and combinations of these four proteins. And this is, again, it was a manual effort in thinking, what's the minimum number of complexes that we needed to introduce to be able to reproduce all of the experimental evidence that we've seen, both in wild type and mutant behavior. So we initially started with fewer complexes, but then we realized that there had to be a way for Frizzle to interact with the Vango prickle inhibitory effect independent of disheveled, because we see, as I mentioned earlier, a different effect if we look at frizzled mutant clones versus disheveled mutant clones. And so we needed a way for frizzled to interact in the feedback loop in a different way from disheveled. So that resulted from the introduction of these complexes. And so it was basically a step-by-step manual procedure to think about carefully and to justify it with the biology as to what's the minimum number of complexes we need to introduce to get all of the experimental behavior. And then these protein interactions are modeled as binding-unbinding reactions. So this reaction says that the disheveled frizzled complex is interacting with the Van Gogh prickle complex, and that's across a cell boundary, so dagger means in the neighboring cell. And they're forming a complex called disheveled frizzled Vango prickle, which is this complex, and that's forming with a forward reaction rate of R9, and it's deforming back into its constituent components with a reverse reaction rate of lambda 9, and R9 and lambda 9 are unknown. We don't know what the global asymmetry signal is, but the hypothesis is that it's provided by a protein like fat, and it probably is fat. So we wanted to introduce the action or possible action of that asymmetry signal in a number of different ways, a number of different biologically feasible ways, and then show that they all work, show that we can identify a model such that with this particular asymmetry signal it works, with this particular asymmetry signal it works. And so two forms of the input asymmetry that we tried out were a reaction-based asymmetric signal in which the reaction that forms the disheveled frizzled complex is initially higher on the distal side of each cell. We also tried a diffusion-based asymmetry signal in which we had a reduced the capability of frizzle to diffuse was initially lower on the distal side of each cell. So there was some asymmetry which is basically causing disheveled and frizzle to initially localize higher on the distal side to break the asymmetry. And both of these are plausible ways in which this feedback loop, this frizzled loop, might read a fat gradient or another global asymmetry signal gradient. Okay, so there are 10 such reactions because I have 4 proteins and 6 complexes. And there were a few other interesting points that we included the reaction-based, so we tried, as I said, 4 or 5 different asymmetry signals. For the reaction-based asymmetry signal, it's encoded through a parameter, so you see this parameter A1, that's a parameter which slows down initially on the distal side the breaking up of disheveled frizzled into its constituent components, and that A comes in wherever you see disheveled and frizzled breaking up, so wherever that breaks up, there's some kind of signal there that's helping to impede that. And then this inhibitory effect, the Van Gogh prickle inhibitory effect, is encoded in the following way through this parameter B. So you see this parameter B. That's basically a parameter which becomes larger as the concentration of Van Gogh prickle and the components containing Van Gogh prickle become higher. So that's tending to act to break up the disheveled frizzle complex as well. So Van Gogh and prickle and things contain. disheveled, frizzled complex, basically as helping to break up the disheveled, frizzled complex, which is more, biologically feasible than saying it's inhibiting. It's forcing those two things to break up.
So PK does this whether or not it's bound to ECHO?
It could. We don't know. We thought we could include just Prickle and Van Gogh here. Prickle and Van Gogh, but we decided that we're going to include not only Prickle and Van Gogh, but also complexes containing Prickle and Van Gogh. So whether or not they're bound to other components, they're still acting to help break up that disheveled, frizzled complex wherever it appears. If we look at just a little more detail, so I took three of those equations, the ones that where you see this disheveled, frizzled complex forming. And so you look at the equation. So this is the equation that I showed earlier. So here's the reaction equations. And so if we want to encode that as a differential equation, we have a net production rate, which is the forward reaction rate minus the backward reaction rate. And so you see, basically, it says that if we look at this equation, so the disheveled frizzled complex can be formed by disheveled and frizzled binding together in a forward reaction, or it can be formed by, and it can be reduced by basically the breaking up of disheveled and frizzled. It can also be formed by complexes which contain disheveled and frizzled breaking up. So this breaking up into its constituent component and increasing the concentration of disheveled. So it's a fairly, it's a standard reaction diffusion equation. A couple of points, what else do I want to say? Okay, so forming a reaction diffusion equation. And then in terms of the diffusion, so the diffusion term was interesting because we have complexes which are, so we have different things. We have cytoplasmic proteins which are diffusing throughout the two-dimensional cell. We have membrane proteins, which are diffusing in the membrane. We have membrane complexes, which are diffusing in the membrane. And then we also have membrane complexes across neighboring cells, and those are restricted to diffuse only in the shared boundary of the two cells. So the way we encode diffusion has to reflect those different ways of diffusing.
So the T variable, the other variables are the location.
Yeah, this represents the spatial location. I mean, and mathematically, this is, at a particular point in time, at a very specific spot in time. Actually, numerically encoding this, we use a finite volume method where we break the cell into small volumes, and we solve this equation over those volumes.
So, and the location is contained in the piece?
Sorry?
The piece of the piece of fluid is a location variable there, too?
Yeah, so these represent the, so at each point in space, at each point in time, we have possibility of having all 10 of these signals. And so these concentrations represent our state variables at each point
location.
In space. Yeah.
Or
1D. And it can even be 1D restricted even more to the shared boundary between the two cells. Okay, so the hardest part about this model building was the parameter selection. So in the full PDE model, we have 10 PDEs. We've got 10 forward reaction rates, 10 reverse reaction rates, 10 diffusion rates, so that's 30 parameters. And then we have additional set of parameters. We have this strength of the initial asymmetry signal. We don't know what that is, so we included it as a parameter. We have parameters which reflect the way that Prickle-Van Gogh inhibits. So you saw those KP, K-Prickle, K-Van Gogh, those are all parameters in the system. So we have altogether 37 parameters and 10 PDEs, and we're solving this over a network of cells. The model parameters are unknown. They're not measurable from the available data. And so what we did to, we've done actually over the course of this project a number of different parameter selection methods. Initially, so we published the initial results of this model last year, and in that publication, we were using a Nelder-Mead simplex method. So basically a numerical search method for identifying parameters, which is slow and difficult and know, as all for nonlinear systems, it's going to find local minima, but it may not converge. And that, you know, it worked because we spent a lot of time on it, and Keith, the student who was working on it, got to know the parameter space really, really well in terms of 37
How did you assess
dimensions.
When you found good parameters?
So that's a good question, and I'll talk about that. But we're basically trying to match, what we want to do is match simulated data with experimental data. So how do we encode that mathematically? I'll talk about it in a second. Recently, over the past several months, we've been building a more mathematically appealing method, faster and really quite cool, I think, method for doing parameter identification. So we have a set of 10 PDEs, 37 parameters, and we've developed, well, we haven't really developed, it's been used a lot in optimal control, a method based on optimal control for identifying these parameters. And we've now matched and gotten better results than the, you know, in terms of matching the experimental data than the results that we published last year. So I'm going to show that method, and then I'm going to basically show the results.
Within this parameter space, is it possible for you to get a completely opposite result? So one set of parameters give you very nice match with the experimental data, the other set is completely opposite.
Yeah, because we encode the initial asymmetry signal. So you could get, I mean, if you mean opposite results, we can get opposite polarity, which
That's
is exactly
right.
wrong.
I'm sorry.
If we don't encode, if we encode the initial asymmetry, you know, if we just make it the inverse of what it is. But I think that that's actually a good result, because then you just have to change one parameter and you get the right results. But yes, it's possible to get a extremely wide range of behaviors with different parameters. And that
what you need at least as asymmetry that you can trigger the system, how much asymmetry?
What's the minimum amount of asymmetry? Yes, and we've spent some time studying that, not only in terms of the strength of that asymmetry signal, but also in terms of how long it has to be there. Can you put that initial asymmetry in for a little bit of time and then turn it off and see if it works? Can you turn it on halfway through and then turn it off and see if it works? And so we've done all of those experiments, and I'll talk a little bit about that too. The answer is basically yes. Once you've got an asymmetry signal, you can have it on for a particular period of that 18 to 30 hours.
Can you 1% or 10% difference, or how much difference you need between the two cells? Or let's say the cleft is very small, so even if you have a gradient in the ring, there's an incredible small space over which you have to get your stuff.
So I'm not sure about the percentage. It can be very weak compared to, if we look at it numerically, compared to the other signals. But the one of the important things that we noted is that it's the most sensitive of all the parameters. So in doing a robustness analysis of these parameters, one would like to see that you can vary the parameters significantly across wide ranges and still get the same behavior. And you can do that with all of the parameters, except the initial asymmetry, you can vary it widely, but not as much as the other signals. Initially, we had a regular geometry. I'll show you the results. Currently, we do a regular, irregular geometry.
So
which
how did you handle the trace issue?
What do you mean by the trace issue?
Well, I mean, you're going to diffuse in one, say, along the edge, and that function could be, in principle, the trace of something inside. And so you have some kind of matching conditions at the bottom.
So the boundary conditions are a lot more difficult to encode for the irregular geometries. I'll talk a little bit about that, but I'm not sure what you mean by we can talk about that a little more afterwards. But yes, that's the hardest problem with irregular geometries. Okay, so basically the parameter identification problem is we have a model which we need to find the parameters. So we can instantiate it with parameters, a guess, simulate it for until 30 hours, and then compare those results with the steady state results, the after 30 hours results from the experiments. And those are the experimental data that we have is basically, I mean, we have some intermediate data, but it's basically at 30 hours or 32, 35 hours after Pupparian forms. So we have a dynamic model where we're trying to match the steady state with steady state experimental data for wild type for all the proteins, for mutants for all the proteins, and for overexpression for all the proteins. So our feature set is contained within a set of about 16 images of these experiments that have been done, but we have more than that because they're images and there's a number of cells on each image. So it's a very challenging problem to try to pick out what features we want to take from each of the images. Okay, so how do we do this? This relates to your question earlier. We form a cost function, which is measuring, basically encoding the deviation between the experimental simulations and the experimentally observed results, and we're trying to choose parameters to minimize that cost function. So, as I said, we initially did it using Nelder Mead Simplex, and now we're doing it using a control theory-based method. This just shows you a little bit about what I said earlier in terms of the feature constraints that we want to match. We have all the wild type data, we have all the clonal data, we have the overexpression data, and then we've got some other data, experimental data. Some of it arises from these sources of controversy that I mentioned earlier. What we'd like to be able to do is identify the parameters on a subset of this data and then validate the model on the set of data that we don't identify on. Okay, so to say a little bit about our parameter identification method. If we encode, so let's represent as the state vector at any point in time and space as the vector of the concentrations of these proteins and protein complexes, then we can encode the reaction diffusion equation simply as here's our reaction diffusion equation where I've just plugged in my state vector instead of, you know, the individual vector, so it's just writing it in vector form. Theta represents the 37-dimensional parameter space, and these are the parameters that we're trying to identify. So we're basically trying to match hair polarity. And so we can encode hair polarity as some function of that those concentrations at the final time across the whole wing. And so then the parameter identification problem, as I said, it becomes one of minimizing a cost function, where that cost function is a function of the parameters, which are unknown. And it's a difference between what we our simulated results and the observed results. And the constraints on that problem are the reaction diffusion equation. So we have an optimization problem in which we're minimizing a cost function subject to a PDE, which depends on the parameter that we're trying to identify.
And you said you were doing it in steady state, right?
We're matching data that's steady state data, so at the final time. We're not, but
you don't really. So it would be subject to that PDE equals zero then.
No, we're doing the. We're actually doing the full-fledged identification over time. So we're including this as a dynamic constraint on the problem.
So that integral there is integrated over time as well then.
What integral? Where?
Your cost function on that is integrated over time and space.
No, the cost function is at the final time. The dynamics are over a period of time, which represents.
So you just run up to some period of time and then.
Yeah, but we want to use the dynamic model in this. And actually, the reason we wanted to include the dynamic model is because we have, when we started this problem, we had only final state data, and we had some intermediate data. Now, Jeff's lab has just bought a microscope that allows in vivo imaging of these fly wings. So we can actually now observe these proteins, how they localize and how they move. You can actually see vesicles, which is something new, of these proteins moving throughout the cells over time. So when we started to do this this optimal control-based method, we decided to, you know, we're going to have cost functions which include the minimizing the deviation over time as well. But right now we're just doing it at steady state. We're doing this at steady state and this over the period of the dynamic evolution of the system.
You just said something that bothered me. You said you can see the proteins being transported in vesicles.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that your diffusion equation is no longer really the relevant model?
Yeah, so this is, okay, so when we started this model, we didn't know anything about active transport of these molecules. And so we decided to make the least restrictive assumption, which is that the molecules are only moving based on diffusion. And basically our justification is that if we can get a model in which it works, so we can identify a model which works with the only motion mechanism being diffusion, then if in the future we observe that there is some possibly active motion mechanism that's moving these molecules around the cell, it should become only easier to identify a model, to identify a set of parameters for that model. So if we include a convection term in these PDEs and identify a model, since it worked with diffusion, it's going to work with the convection model. And about 3 months ago, Imura's lab in Japan found that there are vesicles that are moving frizzled, disheveled around. Frizzled, disheveled, and another protein called Flamingo, which is kind of a structural scaffolding protein, through vesicles. And so over the past 2 months, that experiment is starting to be recreated in Jeff's lab. Okay, so our goal here is to find, basically we want to try to identify the parameters, we want to try to understand how this cost varies with as the parameter varies. And the parameters is, you know, it not only changes this variable, the parameters change the dynamics. So what we would like is basically a way to represent the gradient of the cost, so how the cost changes as a function of the parameter changing. And this is a fairly standard optimal control problem. It's based on a method called the adjoint method, which is used all the time in optimal control. It's used in optimization. It's used in, for example, shape optimization for aerodynamic design. And so one can, given that optimization problem that I showed earlier, one can form an expression for the gradient of the cost function, which depends on this variable Q, which is called a costate, and which satisfies this partial differential equation. So now we have two partial differential equations, and if we could solve this partial differential equation, we'd get a hold of this variable Q, which would then give us a sense of how the cost changes with the parameter. And if we know how the cost changes with the parameter, then we know how to change the parameter so we can minimize the cost.
But the first PDE is backward in time.
The first PDE is forward in time, and the second PDE is backward
that's
in time.
What I mean.
Yeah.
That's the first one.
Right. So we have to use methods to solve this. So we have to solve one PDE forward and one PDE backward. But they're fairly standard methods to do this.
That's very unstable.
But it depends on what the equation is. So, and it depends on what system it's encoding. So the algorithm is to initialize, so guess an initial parameter set, solve the original PDE numerically forward, solve this adjoint PDE backward, and then update the parameter set, so then form the gradient of the cost, and then update the parameter based on, you know, should we decrease it or increase it based on what the, or how should we change that parameter based on what the gradient is. So this is as has been mentioned, it's a standard but fairly tough numerical problem to solve, and a lot depends on the size of your PDE, how many dimensions of the state you have. But the very beautiful thing about this method is it doesn't depend on the number of parameters. So the key complexity, the complexity of solving this PDE comes from the dimension of the underlying state space, which for us is two spatial dimensions at most and time. So if we increase the number of state variables, if we increase the number of parameters, the underlying complexity basically remains as two state variables and time. And so it's a wonderful algorithm to use for parameter identification. Okay, having said that, it's still computationally intensive, and that basically comes from our cost function. We're trying to match a number of these experimental phenotypes. And so we bought a parallel processing machine, and we basically parallelized the code. So we have a number of different codes, a number of different versions of this code running in parallel, which are optimizing different terms in the cost function. This is an algorithm which figures out a clever way to distribute the jobs among processors. And we have encoded the method for computing the cost and the gradient of the cost, and then each of these C code algorithms is solving that PDE, or both PDEs, the forward and the adjoint PDE. Okay, so that's that. That's what we use for parameter.
If you had a problem that was only ODEs, so there wasn't spatial dependence, would your code, again, your Q much better. Just depend, just the ODEs and.
Yeah, and we've done that, and I'll mention that at the end. We had to do it for irregular geometries, we had to simplify this to ODEs. So I'll mention that at the end of the talk, which will be.
So then life is much easier.
Life is easier. Okay, so here, and these are the results that we published last year using the Nelder-Mead simplified method. And as I said, we've now matched all of these parameters and got better results in terms of, you know, lower costs. But basically, we have built a model now where we are able to reproduce everything that we've seen. So here's, for example, just disheveled staining. And if you squint your eyes, you can see the, you know, what you should see, which is that you see sort of vertical zigzags, so disheveled localizing on, well, it's on the distal side. You can't really tell with this image whether it's distal or proximal, but it's distal. And so here's a single cell in an infinite array of cells computationally, and warm colors represent high concentrations, cool colors represent low concentrations. Disheveled and frizzled are localizing distally. Prickle and Van Gogh are localizing proximally.
Okay, so can I ask another question about the observation? It's still just doing a local search, right?
Yes.
So you still have to deal with whether you found.
It's still finding a local minima.
Global minima.
Yeah, and that's all we can. We can't hope to find global minima with this problem. The idea is to, it's fast.
So do you look at multiple local minima?
Is to seed it. Yeah, so to basically seed the algorithm with initial parameters throughout the parameter space and run a number of these in parallel, which we've done. And the more striking results are matching the clones. So you see here we've removed frizzled signal from a patch of cells. You see reverse polarity where you're supposed to see reverse polarity. Van Gogh, you see the opposite effect. So reverse polarity, you see it correcting itself. We're matching trends. So this is basically coming back to how I said we encoded the cost function. We're not saying that, you know, in fact, in this these experiments, the clones are sort of regular, whereas in the, in the computational experiments, the clones are kind of regularly shaped, while in the biological experiments, they're irregularly shaped. So we needed to figure out, you know, how to encode that. So we decided, you know, we didn't want to overfit the data. So what we did was we chose for an image like this, we said, okay, if we remove Van Gogh, we want to make sure that cells on the distal side of the clone have correct polarity, and then cells on the proximal side have reverse polarity for a while. So we choose, on average, 3 cells, and we try to generally match the polarity trends from networks like this.
So all these pictures you're showing, these are results from things that were used in the fitting, in the parameter identification?
This was, yeah, so
okay.
These right now we're just using the I'll show you when we start matching data that we didn't use in the identification. But this was used in the identification. Okay, so here's another one that was used in the identification. And here is, it's, this is coming back to one of the sources of controversy that says, you know, in this model it's not clear that if you increase the amount of prickle, one would expect from this feedback loop to see a reduced amount of disheveled at the boundary. Simulation results tell us otherwise. So here's cells in which we've increased prickle. If you look at disheveled staining, you actually see a higher amount of disheveled at the boundary, which matches that experimental data, which was the original source of controversy. So it's, you know, as a control theorist, we learn that a lot of what you see about feedback is non-intuitive, that just by looking at a localized part of the feedback loop, you can't intuit what's going to happen. The signal, the behavior of disheveled is not only a function of prickle, it's a function of everything that's going on in the feedback loop, and that's what we're seeing here.
Can you tell us why? Is there some intuition from your simulation that says,
yeah, basically,
where you go wrong in thinking that way?
It's just the overcompensation by the other signals in the loop, and it's a function of the parameters that we use in that. Yeah, there are some that, this was one of them that we had to include. There are several that we didn't need to include, and so we just took them out. It would be nice to figure out how to do that analytically, so you could automate that. We did it manually. We realized that if we were able to match frizzle, that it was easy to match prickle. There were some. some that you, if you got one, you didn't need to include the other term in your cost function, and you get that behavior for free. It's not, that would be nice to be able to automate.
What was the minimum number did you see?
Well, so we had, so we have 14 terms in our cost function, but we only needed about 9 or 10. So, and I don't know if that's the minimum, but that's what we observed.
So did you look at, you know, kind of a related question, how independent the parameters were? Typically in systematic models, you see a lot of inner dependence on the models. You might have 30 parameters, but maybe only actually 5 of these.
We can tell that by looking at the gradient of the cost function with respect to the parameters. And that's just data that we're looking at now, is the interdependency of the parameters. I mean, when we did the initial identification, we did a robustness analysis to make sure that the parameters were robust, and we changed, you know, one, and then we changed pairs of parameters, so we could sort of see what some interdependencies are. But just now, looking at these gradients, we're able to see, you know, analytically what the dependencies are. And so that's just data that's coming out now. Okay, so another, so here's some experimental, here's some basically experimental data that we didn't use in the identification process and that led us to some new insights about the biology. Okay, so one of the sources of controversy was that there's an allele of frizzled in which if you remove that frizzled from patches of cells on the wing, you see an autonomous behavior as opposed to the regular frizzled, where if you remove it, you see the non-autonomous behavior. So looking at our model, we said, well, this autonomous frizzled function is very similar to the disheveled function. So we hypothesized that this frizzled autonomous allele, basically its only difference from the original frizzled is that its ability to bind with disheveled has been reduced. And so we propose that the frizzled autonomous allele, in the frizzled autonomous allele, its frizzled disheveled forward reaction binding has been reduced to some small percentage of what it is normally. Okay, so we propose that frizzled autonomous proteins are deficient in complexing with disheveled, but they retain all their other capabilities. They retain their, in particular, they retain their ability to complex with Van Gogh. And then if you look at the non-autonomous frizzled allele, so the one that I was originally talking about, and you remove it, it should lose both interactions. So this is the one we originally saw, where if we remove frizzled from patches of the wing, we see the non-autonomous behavior. So we're proposing that that is deficient in its capability of, it's not there, so it can't, or its function is not there, so it can't bind with disheveled and it can't bind with Van Gogh. Whereas the autonomous frizzled is able to bind with Van Gogh, but it can't, it just loses its ability to bind with disheveled. And so this was an interesting hypothesis because, as I said, we didn't, you know, these bindings are a mathematical hypothesis and we hadn't understood whether or not there's some physical frizzled disheveled complex. So this hypothesis makes two easily testable predictions in the lab. The first is that autonomous frizzled protein recruits Vang to neighboring membranes, but the non-autonomous frizzled protein shouldn't. And the second is that both proteins should fail to recruit disheveled. So you should see failure to recruit disheveled here. And so these were tested by Wei-Shen Chen and Jeff Axel in Jeff's lab. And indeed, we were able to validate both of those predictions. That here we see in the staining for Van Gogh, the non-autonomous fails to recruit disheveled. The autonomous still recruits, sorry, fails to recruit Van Gogh. The autonomous recruits Van Gogh normally. And then if you look at both of them, their ability to recruit disheveled is severely reduced from the wild type. One more experiment, which I call the Lawrence Challenge. So Peter Lawrence is a developmental biologist at Cambridge. He's a planar cell polarity guy, and he published a competing model. He's a factor X guy. And so we sent him a copy of the manuscript, and he said, well, I'm not really sure I believe your model, and I've done a number of experiments, so I'm going to send you the setup for these experiments, but I'm not going to send you the results. And I'd like to you to simulate my experiments in your model and send me back your results, and we'll compare them. And they were funky experiments. You had, like, overexpressed frizzled in a background of a Vang clone, things that you wouldn't, you know, sort of think to even either identify on, or things we didn't even know about because they hadn't been published yet. And the exciting thing is that we sent the results back and we were 3 for 3. So we were able to match all of the behaviors. He was doing the experiment in the body of the fly, not in the fly wing, but qualitatively, you know, the experiments all matched in terms of the polarities that were observed. Okay, so. Basically, we were looking at the direction. So there were a couple of things we were looking at there. The direction of the hairs. It's hard to see from this image. But also, there were some interesting artifacts. So you see that there's this sort of ring of cells here where, so inside the clone, you still get a ring of cells in one case in which the hairs are pointing out, whereas that doesn't happen on the interior cells. So we were matching features like that. And we can talk about it some more. I can show you the images in more detail.
So if you picked the wrong features?
We didn't pick any features here.
Okay.
We just simulated our model. We just set up the experiment.
Okay.
So now we have fixed our model. We didn't do any identification.
Okay.
Yeah. But
the
we know
that. Could you quantify how well the simulations and experiments agree?
It's quantified by qualitative observation. And that's a challenge, I think, that's been going on, is that we want the images to look right. I mean, we want Jeff to look at that, or some other biologist who knows this, to look at that and say, yeah, you know, these are right. And so by Peter Lawrence looking, who's one of the naysayers, looking at it and saying, okay, that looks right, that is, we consider that a success. Okay, so we've identified a model. It basically shows the plausibility of this biological interaction. It doesn't prove that the model is correct. And maybe there's going to be more data that comes along that disproves the model. But for now, it's basically reproduced all known phenotypes. It also allowed us to give us some insights into non-autonomy. So it allowed us to predict this disheveled frizzled interaction and to predict or to try to better understand the behavior of frizzled autonomous alleles. It predicted other phenotypes not used to train the model. So to conclude, what about fat? So this was the interesting experiment that I talked about earlier, where in some fat clones you see that polarity is propagated, and in some you see that polarity is disrupted. So we studied hundreds of images of fat clones. Actually, Dali studied hundreds of images. She made and studied hundreds of images of fat clones. And we proposed that in the absence of this proposed global directional cue, that cells, the local feedback loop is still operating fine, and cells are determining their polarity, they're getting the sort of replacement global directional cue from perturbations in the cell packing. So we propose that it's actually the cell geometry that is causing the, basically the polarity patterns in the absence of the global directional cue. And so that actually, by studying the mutant, we're sort of saying that there's this kind of fight going on between a signal, which is providing the global directional cue, which our little feedback loop is amplifying, and aberrations in geometry of cells, little defects, so that when you remove this global directional cue, the aberrations take over. And so if you look at the clones, and typically this is clones that have nice regular cell geometry, polarity is propagated beautifully. But it's in those cells where you see the geometry, so here I have a long, thin cell, and the interesting thing is it's actually where in cells where the geometry is most aberrant that the swirly patterns start. And so that's an observation we made. And so the question, the hypothesis is that polarity defects are a consequence of the frizzled feedback loop when confronted with a regular cell geometry. So we tested this, and to test this, we needed to build irregular cell geometries. We needed to modify our model, new boundary conditions, a lot of time and detail in building an ordinary differential equation model. And that was actually done. We observed that in the PDE model, the diffusion constants were orders of magnitude higher than the reaction constants, so we assumed that diffusion was happening infinitely fast and built a mathematical ODE model. So all the details are quite interesting. But then we did a number of experiments. Actually, Dali did a number of experiments in quantifying the relationship between clones with regular cell geometry and irregular cell geometry. And then she did some experiments in which she removed certain proteins, and which actually are known to affect the shape of the cells, and then studied those to understand whether or not cell geometry causes the disruption of polarity. And then the third thing was our simulation. So we built an OD model, looked at, And so, so what we wanted to do was have a model. So we took our same model, we simulated it over irregular cell geometries, which were extracted now, automatically extracted from images. And we wanted to see a match between basically propagation of polarity, so cells which propagate polarity, we wanted to be able to simulate that correctly, and we wanted to be able to match, again, cells. So when we saw the clones, there was a disruption in polarity, we basically wanted to be able to see a disruption of polarity in the simulation as well. And the results are good. I mean, they're good enough to say that the cell geometry is, there's a causality between cell geometry and polarity. And we haven't quite matched the swirly patterns yet, but we're getting there. Okay, so to conclude, we demonstrated the sufficiency of the model and demonstrated that factor X is unnecessary. We derived insights into the nature of domineering non-autonomy. We proposed and conducted some experiments which helped reinforce this. We developed analytical tools for parameter identification based, I talked about the adjoint method. We've also done this for hybrid systems. We now have new data, as I talked about, sort of time series data. And so we're excited about thinking about whether the model matches this, how might we update the model. We're interested in general in thinking about PCP as a module that's interacting not only with the, you know, how the wing is formed, but also other mechanisms in fly development, in particular fly legs. And we've started a new project with some other biologists at Stanford who are studying lymphoma, who are sort of at the same starting point as we were 5 years ago with this PCP system, thinking about building models for helping to understand lymphoma.